Anything else on your mind, just let me know. I'll be as transparent as possible. Beckham smiled kindly at that. He liked this man already, and not just because he reminded him of Lieutenant Colonel Jensen. Presley was truly an intelligent leader. You mentioned scouts earlier. Do you have any outside the walls right now? Beckham asked. Drones in the sky and my best men on the ground at all times, Presley replied. Good. That's the one thing we really failed at back in Portland, but resources were also a lot tighter. Beckham stepped to the side of the rooftop. If the variants do come, we need plenty of warning to get people into shelters. Agreed, Presley said. I'll see if we can widen our scouts' range. Beckham nodded again. For the first time in weeks, he felt like his family was relatively safe, even with the mastermind here. If you'll accept a compliment from a company-grade officer. This is good work, sir, Beckham said. Presley clapped him on the shoulder and smiled. Anything else, Captain? Beckham glanced at his watch. It was already late afternoon. If you'd excuse me, sir, I'd like to go see how my wife and the science team are doing. Let me know if there is anything we can do for your family while you're here, Presley said. Likewise, sir, Beckham said. I'm here to help. He gave a nod to Fisher, but Fisher followed him away from the railing.
Mind if I join you, Captain? Fisher asked. I want another look at that ugly bastard.
Beckham didn't really want company, but he also didn't want to disrespect a person so crucial to the war effort. Sure, he replied. They went to the street and walked to the lab building, accompanied by the two guards that Fisher had brought with them, Tran and Chase. Neither of the men spoke, other than to say hello to Beckham. They scanned the streets and people for threats, clearly taking their job protecting Fisher very seriously.
Your family is here? Fisher asked.
Yes, we decided to bring them along. I worry less when they're close, and President Ringgold assured me this is one of the safest outposts. Fisher put on his cowboy hat.
General Cornelius did a good job making Outpost Galveston pretty damn secure, too. I was there not long ago.
That's good to hear, and especially since he's working with President Ringgold, even though he's retired.
He's not retired. General Cornelius is doing more to save the Allied States than you might know.
I'm aware of his commitments.
I need to be honest with you, Fisher interrupted again. A war hero like you probably has a better perspective on this than me. But I was always taught to back the best horse in the race, and that is, without a doubt, the general.
Beckham halted and faced Fisher. The two guards moved away to give them some space. The only race right now is the one for survival, Mr. Fisher, Beckham said. I'm not interested in talking politics or who to support now that the election is on hold. I'm interested in saving our country so that someday we can have that conversation.
Fair enough. But I urge you to make some time to talk with General Cornelius. Your talents might be better spent keeping a closer dialogue going with him than you'd expect.
I work for the president.
Of course. I mean no disrespect.
Beckham kept walking, slightly frustrated. Fisher kept up, and his guards closed back in around them. The sound of diesel engines provided a welcome distraction to the awkward silence that passed between them on the rest of the journey to the lab. People walking on the street moved to the side as a convoy of armored vehicles turned down the road and raced past Beckham and Fisher. Soldiers gripped machine guns in the turrets of Humvees. Beckham looked toward where they were heading, and a dark pit formed in his stomach. The first Humvee had already stopped right in front of the lab, and soldiers had piled out. Tran and Chase both cradled their rifles, looking around, clearly nervous by the commotion. They weren't the only ones caught off guard. The security Beckham felt slipped away at the sight of a strike team speeding to the location where his wife was working. It reminded him that the biggest threat from an enemy wasn't always from the outside. Sometimes it came from within.
Chapter 17. Team Ghost had slept on the C-130H flight to Palo Alto, California, refueling their energy reserves after their successful mission to New Orleans. 8 hours ago, Dohai and the team had changed aircraft at a FOB in Alabama. Now Dohai sat in one of the mess jumper seats against the plane's sand-colored fuselage beside Ace, who was still snoring on his left, with his arms folded over his chest and belly. Mendez was another seat down, clutching a rosary. Rico and Fitz were on his right, talking quietly amongst themselves. She smiled, dimples forming at something he said. Dohai usually envied them, but not today. Today he needed the silence. He surveyed the Orca soldiers across the tracks and bolts of the deck. The Wolfhounds, a platoon-sized group of 20 soldiers led by Lieutenant Gurman Singh, were all seated alongside the opposite bulkhead. The team was a hodgepodge of former mercenaries and militia who had joined General Cornelius's private army. Another group of soldiers with Orca badges sat near the cockpit, but they would be staying back to guard the plane during the mission. Dohai had listened to them talk on the long trip across the country. From what he gathered, the Wolfhounds had spent most of the past 8 years working in the field on missions hunting collaborators and variants outside of Galveston. But this mission had pushed them out of their element, and Lieutenant Singh had made it clear Fitz was in charge. Their rank meant nothing, because the Orca soldiers weren't part of the Allied States Army, and so long as they were out in variant territory, the Wolfhounds would defer to Team Ghost. Dohai just hoped their new friends lived up to their namesake, but thus far he wasn't impressed. The nervous tap of boots echoed in the aircraft while the soldiers looked out the windows. They were beginning their descent over the coast of California. A low-lying fog blanketed most of the landscape. A few skeletal skyscrapers pierced the sky like broken bones through flesh, some of their upper levels sheared off.
"It's a graveyard down there," said one of Singh's men.
Ace stirred awake, pulling his folded arms away from his chest.
Is that San Jose we just passed?"
asked one of the Wolfhounds.
"Yeah, I think so," answered the first soldier.
"We haven't seen anything yet," said a Wolfhound soldier with a spider neck tattoo. "The shit at ground level is the really bad stuff. I heard there are mutant animals out there with the variants."
"Martin, what did I tell you about sharing conspiracy shit?" Singh asked.
"LT, it ain't conspiracy shit," Martin replied.
He toyed with a gold chain that had a gold AK-47 pendant on it. The young man was another example of a former merc-turned-soldier. A man with a scraggly beard and deep-set green eyes chuckled. His name tape read Hopkins.
"You got to learn the difference between reality and your damn nightmares."
"Shit is real, brah," Martin added. "I heard about a guy that saw some dogs that looked half zombie. That VX-99 stuff can make animals crazy."
"That was just a rabid dog," Hopkins said. "Not VX-99. You do know the difference, don't you? The shit doesn't work on animals."
"You sure about that?" Martin asked, one eyebrow raised.
Ace leaned over to Dohai and whispered,
"These guys are like puppies at a fireworks show. Nervous as hell."
Dohai gave a half nod. Truth was, the Wolfhounds weren't the only nervous ones. The difference between Ghost and these guys was that Dohai and his teammates knew how to control the fear. Countless missions behind enemy lines had taught them to handle their fear and use it to their advantage. Newbies like Martin and Hopkins didn't. And that's what made Dohai really nervous.
"Dios Dios, if this is Cornelius's best, we're fucked," Mendez said quietly.
He slipped his rosary back in his chest pocket. Rico narrowed her eyes, leaning in so the Wolfhounds wouldn't overhear.
"Come on, amigo. You don't remember your first drop into uncharted territory?"
Ace chuckled again.
"I heard you pissed yourself."
"That's a damn lie," Mendez said. "Stepped into a creek. Sure smelled like piss, though."
"Whatever you say, man," Rico said.
Fitz shook his head.
"Guys, come on."
San Jose disappeared into the distance, and Dohai turned back to the troop hold as the plane descended toward the coastline. Dark waves lapped over a wide, pebbly beach beneath sheer cliffs.
"All right, listen up," Fitz said. "Our mission is to infiltrate the National Accelerator Laboratories and retrieve all the SDS equipment and available intel on Project Rolling Stone."
He paused a moment.
"We'll move in two units, with members of Team Ghost leading both. Lieutenant Singh has command of the Wolfhounds, but for the purposes of this mission, I'm top dog. We get in, find the material we need, bring it back to the plane, and we're out of here. If you listen to orders, stay frosty, and keep your eyes open, we'll all go home. Understood?
Most of the soldiers nodded. It was clear they looked up to Team Ghost, which was good, because that hopefully meant they would listen to them in the field. But there were a few that didn't seem to appreciate the ad hoc rank structure.
What about enemies? Martin asked. You gonna tell us what to expect down there?
SOCOM doesn't have much intel on this area, Fitz said.
What's that mean? Hopkins asked.
They have to know something.
Rico plucked a piece of chewing gum from her helmet.
There could be collaborators, could be variants, could even be some invaders from another country looking to take some land when we're not looking, Fitz said. We're prepared to face any threat. Anything with a weapon should be considered hostile, but you do not engage unless fired upon. Stealth is our primary weapon here.
I heard all the collaborators moved east, Martin said. Same with the variants. After all, that's where all the food is.
Martin, shut your trap and listen, Singh said. For all we know, variants have been camping out here underground for the past 8 years just like they were back east, Fitz said. Maybe breeding, too.
Dohai was prepared mentally for anything. After all, the one thing he had learned in the apocalypse was that unpreparedness was the worst enemy.
Once we reached the freeway outside the National Accelerator campus, we split up to cover more ground, Fitz said. Lieutenant, you and 10 men are with me, Rico and Ace. Dohai and Mendez, you take the other 10.
Fitz finished his orders as the plane dipped. There were no other questions. Just solemn looks and whispered prayers. One of the wolfhounds leaned down, and Dohai thought he was going to puke, but he managed to keep all of the food in his gut.
Get ready, Fitz yelled.
The big airplane touched down, the troop hold rattling. When it eased to a stop, the crew chief lowered the rear ramp.
Go, 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 Fitz yelled.
Dohai immediately took point at Fitz's signal, spearheading the group as they charged out into the sand, rifles at the ready to set up a perimeter. As soon as the last soldier was out, Dohai took point. He found the remnants of a trail that had once been a hiking path marked with rusted signs. It was now overgrown with weeds and brambles, but it would be no problem for him to find his way through, even with the fog. It took an hour of hiking in silence through the muck and tall grass shadowed by trees before Dohai paused at the crest of a wooded hill. The higher ground, too, was suffocated by the ominous fog. He was unable to see more than the trees clawing through the gray a few dozen yards in front of him. The other members of Team Ghost gathered beside him to figure out their next move. Beside them trailed the wolfhounds, all organized into combat intervals. The chirp of birds was reassuring. It meant there probably weren't variants in the area. For now, Dohai would take this as a good omen. But he didn't like the fog. Fitz didn't either.
We're only a few miles out from our target, but we could be walking into an ambush set by anything or anyone that saw the plane, he said. You want to hold here a bit and see if the fog clears? Singh asked.
Fitz thought on it, shooting Dohai a glance first.
We need to keep moving, Fitz said. Dohai will make sure we don't wander into a trap. Tell your men to keep frosty and report anything suspicious.
You got it, Singh said, before turning back to his platoon. Fitz signaled to move out. A cold wind blowing in from the west sent chills up Dohai's flesh. He kept his ears perked for the singing birds, letting them know that they were safe. But he knew they weren't safe by any means. They were in variant country now, the deepest anyone had been in years, and the question wasn't if they would encounter the beasts, it was when.
Coyote is always out there waiting, and Coyote is always hungry.
More words from his grandfather haunted his thoughts. The soldiers speared through the fog behind Dohai, and he guided them deeper into a field blackened by fire. Skeletal trees twisted out of the ash-covered dirt. The birds had stopped chirping, but he saw no tracks from animals, variants, or humans. Nothing living at all. Fitz gestured for Dohai to keep pushing forward, and Dohai brought his rifle back up to his shoulder, scanning the haze for hostiles. His boots crunched over branches that fell away into dust. Somewhere, a crow cawed. A breeze rustled over the crisped plants. The hair on the back of his neck stood straight. From the tendrils of gray fog emerged a cluster of living trees. Not much grass grew along the ground, but leaves covered it as densely as the fog choked the landscape. Something about those leaves looked wrong to Dohai, kind of like he was looking at a forged $100 bill. He stopped and thrust his fist in the air, trusting his gut.
"What's up?" Fitz whispered.
Dohai jerked his chin toward the leaves. Fitz gave him a cockeyed gaze at first, seeming to be confused. Then realization dawned over him, too. The leaves only rustled a little when the wind blew over them, but never flew away. They were too perfectly dispersed along the ground. Dohai knelt and peeled back some that were stuck to the ground. Instead of coming up separately, they came up in one big carpet, exposing a pit nearly 6 feet deep. Pungy spikes jutted up from the dark soil at the bottom. The chamber spread along to the north and south, bordering the burned-down woods nearly 20 feet in length. A rotten odor drifted up from the freshly revealed booby trap. They hadn't been the first to discover it, but those that came before had seen it when it was too late. Dohai crouched for a better look at the bodies impaled by the spikes. Two of them had grown leathery and dry. A fresher corpse was covered in white maggots crawling out of a misshapen skull. It took him a moment to realize they weren't humans. The corpses were variants. Someone had set a trap for the monsters. Dohai rose to his feet. "The enemy of my enemy is my friend," he thought. Maybe the adage would prove true. But something told him these people, whoever they were, could be just as big of a threat as the monsters. Two guards wearing black fatigues with the Raven logo stood outside another entrance to the laboratory. A line of armored vehicles and Humvees were parked in a semicircle in the parking lot, providing a second line of defense around the building housing the mastermind. Fisher and his guards had waited outside with Beckham for over an hour, trying to figure out what was going on. But even after telling them who they were, the heavily armed guards would not grant them access to the lab. Every minute that passed, Beckham grew angrier. Fisher had a feeling things were about to get heated.
"This is such fucking bullshit," Beckham said.
Tran and Chase looked at Fisher, but he shook his head to keep them from getting involved.
"Screw this," Beckham said.
He set off for the vehicles. The soldier in the closest turret shouted, "This is authorized access only."
"My wife is inside," Beckham yelled.
He marched toward the line of armored vehicles. Gun barrels rotated toward him.
"Stop, sir," yelled the same soldier in the turret.
"Ah, horseshit," Fisher said.
He walked after Beckham despite protests from Tran and Chase.
"I said halt," the soldier yelled. "You're gonna have to shoot me," Beckham shouted back.
Fisher twisted toward the sound of squealing tires. A Humvee came to an abrupt stop in front of the parked MATVs and other armored vehicles forming a barrier in front of the lab facility. The soldiers in turrets pushed their barrels up as the passenger side door opened. Colonel Presley got out and hurried over to the entrance.
"What the hell is going on?" Beckham asked. "If my wife is in danger, I..."
"She's not," Presley said.
"My men are just following strict orders to keep this place secure. Your wife is safer in there than out here, Captain. I need you to come with me."
Fisher wasn't sure what in the Sam Hill was happening now. The sun was already going down on the horizon. Soon, darkness would swallow them, bringing with it the evil monstrosities it concealed. His fingers caressed the handle of his holstered pistol. Tran and Chase picked up on his worry, shifting their rifles up out of relaxed mode.
"Captain, let's go with the colonel," Fisher suggested. "Assuming that is, my men and I may also join. I have enough manners to bow out of a dinner party I'm not invited to."
"Of course," Presley nodded. "You're free to come with us, Mr. Fisher, as are your men."
Beckham looked back at the lab entrance, and then reluctantly walked over to the Humvee with Fisher and his guards.
"You need to promise me the lab is safe," Beckham said. "Safest place here with all this security,"
Presley said, gesturing. Now, you coming with me or not?
He hopped into the front passenger seat, not waiting for an answer. Fisher got in the back with Beckham and his men.
Our scouts spotted packs of juveniles on the outskirts of the outpost, Presley said as the truck pulled away. About 2 clicks out from the main wall. They're small packs, the equivalent of a recon unit.
How many of these packs have you spotted in the past? Beckham asked.
None. This is the first time we've seen variants so close.
They know the mastermind is here, don't they?
Fisher asked, cold realization hitting him like an unexpected blizzard in Texas.
Beckham cursed. That's what I was afraid of.
I'm hoping that's not the case, but either way I'm not taking any chances and don't believe in coincidences any more than you do, Presley said. I've got all hands on deck and we're moving civilians into the shelters for the night.
My family, Beckham said. That apartment had glass windows. If we're hit with bats, the building has a shelter in the basement, Presley reassured him. There are guards on the roof. The street is completely blocked off, and our aerial defenses are locked, cocked, and ready for any threat.
Fisher could tell Beckham wasn't convinced.
Sir, all due respect, but are you sure you don't have any collaborators in your midst? Beckham asked. How else could the variants know about the mastermind?
Presley didn't hesitate even a second in his answer.
Captain, I told you that we do not have a collaborator problem here.
That's what we thought in Portland.
Beckham ran a hand through his hair, pulling it back.
We underestimated them. I underestimated them. And I've lost a lot of friends and my home because of it.
I'm sorry for your losses, but this isn't Outpost Portland, Presley said.
Fisher turned to look out the windows on the drive. They sped through empty streets in silence, the fiery glow of a sunset retreating on the horizon. He repositioned his holstered .357 Magnum, fearing that the silence was about to be shattered by the screech of monsters. He had listened quietly back at the command building while Presley explained how safe this place was to Beckham, and all of the things they had done to ensure it never fell. And while Fisher wanted to believe the defenses were as good as Presley kept saying, he remembered Cornelius's ominous warning about not trusting anyone. The driver steered the Humvee toward a cluster of tents at the far reaches of the walls. Soldiers hurried back and forth, carrying equipment from a stack of crates being unloaded from the back of a flatbed. Others worked at tables under a camouflage tent that shielded computers and electronic equipment from view and rain. Swollen clouds rolled in from the west across the purple skyline, threatening storms.
This is it, Presley said. Won't take more than 15 minutes.
Fisher put on his hat and stepped out of the vehicle. He followed Beckham and Presley into a tent furnished with metal tables with computer monitors. A young female officer with short hair and blue eyes stood to attention, then backed away to give them all room.
Colonel, this is live footage from our scouts, she said.
Fisher leaned down to look with Beckham and Presley. At first glance, Fisher didn't see anything. That wasn't entirely surprising. The beasts were probably camouflaged. The officer that had brought up the live feed used a finger to point at the hilltop. There the weeds moved back and forth, and Fisher glimpsed a flash of gray armored flesh.
They've just been sitting there for the past hour, she said, and we've picked up more units like this at 2 other locations.
She went to a mobile board with a map of the outpost. Using a pen, she noted spots on all sides of the perimeter.
We're being surrounded, Presley said.
Beckham stiffened and wiped sweat from his brow.
They're definitely scoping out the defenses.
Fisher had personal experience with the depths of their organized intellect, but this was on an entirely new level.
Colonel, we have more movement, said another officer.
The man walked over with a handset.
Just got word some of the juvies are taking off.
Follow them with a drone or a recon team.
Your best team, Beckham said. We need to know where they're going. If we can, then we locate the horde, or hive, or whatever is out there.
Presley acted slightly annoyed by what sounded like orders, but he agreed and nodded at the officer with the handset.
Anything else I should know? Beckham asked. I'd like to personally make sure my family is safe before shit hits the fan.
No, Captain. Thank you, Presley said.
Keep me updated on things, please.
Of course.
I'll get you a radio before we have someone drive you back to the building so you don't find yourself waiting again.
Presley looked Beckham in the eye.
Sorry about what happened outside the lab. It was a misunderstanding.
Beckham nodded and left the tent.
Thanks for the updates, Fisher said.
He followed Beckham and joined his men outside, feeling completely useless. Waiting on Team Ghost and the SDS equipment was really starting to make his visit here a drag. He hoped whatever was taking Ghost so long would be resolved soon.
Mr. Fisher, I'd suggest going to one of those shelters if you want a ride, Beckham said.
He walked toward a pickup truck where a soldier waited.
I have a feeling tonight is going to be a long one, Beckham added.
Fisher tipped his leather hat.
I appreciate the advice, Captain, but I'm not the kind of buck that goes scampering at the first sign of danger.
Suit yourself, Beckham said.
He got inside the truck, and the driver pulled away. Fisher watched him go, hoping the captain was wrong. One thing was certain, Fisher wasn't going to cower in some shelter. He was done hiding a long time ago.
Chapter 18 Timothy sat quietly in an exam room that looked like it had been pulled straight from the doctor's office he used to visit as a kid. It was even furnished with a table that had bedding on it. But there weren't serene pictures of mountains or rivers on the walls. The only decoration was a banner hanging over the closed door with a misshapen skull, the same banner he had seen in the briefing room. Alfred had brought him here and told him to get into the green scrubs he wore now. According to the tag, the scrubs were supposed to be size medium, a size that had once fit snugly on Timothy's frame. Now it hung as loose as a sail. His stomach growled. He was hungry again. No, he was starving. He had hardly eaten in the past few days. Food wasn't the only thing on his mind. He had sat here for hours with nothing to do but worry and try and figure out why the hell they had brought him down here. Thoughts of his father, of Tasha, and all the people back in Portland haunted his mind. He tried to conjure happy memories, anything to assuage the ball of dread growing in his stomach, but he failed every time. All he could do was stare at that strange skull on the banner. Now he was more sure than ever that he knew what it was. The thing was a damn variant. It had to be, and it made sense after his conversation with Nick. The man had sold his soul to the monsters. Everyone down here had. While he had figured that much out, there was still so much that didn't make sense. Normally, at least from what he had heard, collaborators worked for the monsters. But the ones here controlled them. The shock collar, the concerted attacks. Timothy didn't see how that could be possible. There had to be something he was missing. The collaborators his dad had told him about worked for powerful alpha variants, monsters that were both twisted and intelligent in their own strange ways. Maybe there was an even more intelligent variant out there working with the collaborators now. Some beast that Nick, Alfred, and Pete had sworn loyalty to. Timothy grew more anxious as he waited for the men to return. He got off the table and walked over to the door, trying the knob. It twisted, but a click confirmed it was still locked from the outside. Was this some kind of test? Were they watching him through a hidden camera, seeing if he was smart enough to escape, or loyal enough to listen? He glanced at the banner again as he stood in front of the door. These men must have some awfully good reasons to swear fealty to monsters that wanted to kill so many people. Or maybe everyone down here was just batshit insane. But there was an even bigger question that Timothy couldn't bury, one that emerged from the emotions roiling in his chest, a question he wondered every time he looked at Nick, Alfred, and Pete. Had they been there the night his father died on Peaks Island? Had one of them pulled the trigger? In time, he would know. That was what mattered most. Once he figured that out, he would happily return the favor and put a bullet in that man's brain. Then everyone else loyal to the monsters. He returned to the table, fists clenched. Maybe they were watching him. He wouldn't give them the satisfaction of going nuts. Taking long, deep breaths,
He tried to force himself to remain calm, but the longer he sat there, the more he boiled over, until he found himself pressing his fingers into his palms with his filthy, overgrown nails.
"You're gonna get yourself killed," he thought to himself.
The only way he was going to get revenge was if he played it cool. If he did that, then he had a chance to bring down this entire shadowy organization. Watch, listen, learn. The words his dad had taught him echoed in his mind. Timothy let his hands relax and closed his eyes, counting to 10. When he hit 10, he took a deep breath, then counted to 10 again. Over and over, a silent meditation. He tried to think of good thoughts, like what it had been to be back on Peaks Island, the trees and water surrounding him, being able to spend time with Tasha, running off together with their friends to go hiking and explore the landscape, spending long nights on the shores. He had no idea how much time had passed when the door finally clicked and slowly creaked open. Timothy tensed, sitting as straight as he could. A balding doctor, maybe 50 years of age, walked into the room wearing a white lab coat and holding a clipboard. Behind him, two bearded men wearing fatigues stood guard with machine guns. They remained in the hallway, and the doctor kept the door open.
"State your full name," he said.
His eyes may as well have been pools of darkness, not the kind that Timothy remembered on his doctor at home. This man had seen too much death.
"Your full name," the doctor entreated.
"Timothy Lance," he lied. The doctor looked down at his clipboard and scribbled something onto the paper. Then he moved over toward the table. Timothy flinched when he reached out for him.
"Relax. I'm going to do some basic tests to make sure you're healthy."
Timothy wasn't sure if he believed that, but he decided it didn't matter. The two guys with machine guns in the hall gave him no choice but to obey. For the next 30 minutes, Timothy endured many of the same tests he remembered from his normal physicals with his physician. The doctor took his blood pressure, listened to his heart and lungs. He even made him stick his tongue out using a wooden depressor to see the back of his throat. When he finished, he scribbled some more on his clipboard and left without saying another word, closing the door behind him. Timothy tried to relax on the cold seat. All he could do was wonder what the hell all that had been about. When the door opened again, the doctor returned and gestured for Timothy to follow him into the hall. The two guards accompanied them down the narrow passage with a tiled floor and white walls. The air carried a sterile smell, like a laboratory. They took a right at an intersection and entered a hall with glass windows. More armed guards stood outside a set of doors with biohazard signs. On the other side of the glass windows, scientists in bulky hazmat suits worked inside an open laboratory with metal tables. Several of the workers surrounded a clear plastic container with some sort of rodent inside. Timothy slowed to get a better view.
"Move it," said one of the escort guards.
They passed another lab, where a monkey with bandaged legs screeched inside a cage, rattling the bars with its hands while a scientist watched.
What the hell were they doing down here?
His mind raced. He had assumed they were checking his health, like the doctor said. Now he wondered if he was about to become a test subject. They continued past more labs, but these were empty and dark inside. Not completely dark, Timothy realized. He stopped, squinting to try and make out what looked like glowing eyes. The eyes belonged to a bulky animal that trotted on four legs, moving toward the window.
"What in God's?"
Timothy whispered. The doctor turned and walked back to Timothy while one of the guards laughed.
"You aren't afraid of dogs, are you?" he asked.
This was no dog inside the dark room. Not anymore. The beast was a monster with thick muscles and a spiky back. Veins bulged from light brown skin.
"Let's go," said the other guard.
He elbowed Timothy hard in the back, pushing him forward. They didn't stop again until they got to another wing of labs. The doctor stopped at a door and opened it with the flash of a keycard.
"Come with me,"
he said to Timothy. They walked into a white laboratory, the guards staying outside. At the center of the room was a single person in a white coat. He had his back turned and was working on something on a metal cart next to a chair with leather straps. Timothy's eyes turned to the cart, inspiring a pang of nausea. On the top sat two long needles, a black collar, and an open toolkit.
"Sir, I've brought the recruit," said the doctor.
"Ah, Timothy," said a familiar voice as the man in the white coat turned.
Dread snaked its way through Timothy's insides. It was Nick.
"Have a seat,"
he said, gesturing toward a chair. Timothy hesitated at the sight of the open leather straps on the armrests.
"What are you going to do?"
Timothy asked. He shivered, unable to hold back his fear or his thoughts.
"You're going to turn me into one of those creatures? Wow. You must really think I'm the monster, huh?"
Timothy didn't reply, and Nick followed his gaze to the metal cart with the tools and the needles.
"Oh, those," Nick said. "Well, you didn't think we were going to induct you into our army without some insurance, did you?"
He laughed. The doctor picked up the collar.
"We didn't live in the shadows all this time because we're stupid," Nick said. "We've planned every move."
"You'll wear this until you can be trusted," the doctor said.
"Now have a seat," Nick said, his voice deeper.
Timothy did as instructed. His mind whirled, trying to figure a way out of this, but he came up with nothing. The doctor walked around the chair and started tightening the leather straps around his arms and legs.
"This one's a healthy young man," he said.
Nick nodded and patted Timothy on the shoulder.
"That's good, because you, my friend, are going to be very important to our master. I've been told he has special plans for you."
"Master?" Timothy asked.
"In time, you'll learn more," Nick said.
He grabbed a syringe with a long needle and held it up toward a light. Timothy recoiled.
"Don't worry."
Nick flicked the syringe, loosening a couple bubbles.
"I didn't just lie about my family being dead. I also lied about being a dentist. I was actually a lab technician. Something that's come in very handy for our plans."
Timothy swallowed hard, wondering what else Nick had lied about. There was one thing he knew for sure. The collaborators were far better organized than anyone on the outside had imagined. Nick stuck him in the arm with the needle, and a wave of heat rushed through his veins. Then came a feeling of cool relief and exhaustion. Timothy tried to keep his eyelids open, but they grew heavier by the second. His vision started to blur as he watched the two men prepare the collar and what looked like a small microchip. Any illusions he had about escaping vanished. As he drifted off, he thought of his dad. He knew in his heart that his father would have wanted him to forget about revenge and focus on stopping whatever these men had planned.
"You are the only one that can stop them now," he heard his father say. "I trained you for this."
And then there was only darkness.
"I'm moving the kids to a shelter just in case," Beckham said through the intercom.
Kate stood on the other side of a glass window in the laboratory trying to make sense of what he had just told her about the juvenile scouts. She was alone in an antechamber to the larger lab trying to keep calm. All of a sudden, she felt trapped, like the mastermind in the chamber. And the thought of Javier and the kids hiding in a basement shelter in a place she told them would be safe sent a pang of regret through her.
"Don't worry, Kate," Beckham said as if he could read her thoughts. "Horn and I'll make sure the kids are okay. You just focus on your work."
"I'm trying, but..."
"Really? Everything will be fine, I promise."
She wanted to believe that. But if the variants really knew the mastermind was here, there would be hell to pay. Her husband helped make her feel a little better. But still, there was the burning question about the juveniles and how they would have known the beast had been brought here. They hadn't connected the creature to the external webbing network, and the top-secret landing during the dead of night had only been known by the science team and trusted military members. She hit the intercom button.
"Do you think Colonel Presley has taken care of any collaborators here?"
"The Colonel is confident we have nothing to fear."
"But you aren't."
Beckham hesitated.
No, I'm not.
Sammy entered the room behind her and said, Dr. Lovato, we need you back in the lab. Just a minute, Kate said. Sammy nodded and exited back to the main lab.
Go, Beckham said. I'll take care of things. The kids, collaborators. I can handle it.
She looked at the clock. It was 7:35. I still plan on taking my break to see you all if I can, she said.
He put a hand on the glass and she matched it with her gloved hand.
Kate returned to the lab, trying to manage her heartbeat. She was shaken up by the news that juvenile scouts had been spotted around the outpost, but decided to keep it to herself for now. Saying anything could throw off her team, and she trusted they would be alerted if it was absolutely necessary, by staff or by her husband.
Focus, Kate. You have to focus.
She and Carr had to unravel the mystery of the Mastermind network. There was no room for failure. As soon as she re-entered the chamber, she spotted Carr hunched over a lab table. By him was Sammy and another computer engineer engrossed in their work. All around, she noticed the same determination in the other scientists, engineers, and lab technicians. Dressed in white clean room suits and masks, they worked hurriedly at the banks of computer terminals and filtered between the huge iron columns in the center of the three-story room. Others carted supplies and samples to different lab benches. The 20-person team was a significant upgrade from when it was just her and Dr. Pat Ellis in the early days of the war. But while she had not grown as close to Dr. Carr as she had been with Ellis, at least she respected the man's work and drive. It would be people like him, intelligent and steadfast, that enabled them to survive the coming days and weeks, the crucial tipping point of the war that they were currently losing. Kate crossed the lab to Dr. Carr and Sammy, navigating the maze of lab stations and bustling staff. While she had grown accustomed to working with this large group and this enormous space, there was one thing she could never get used to. The constant odor of rot and sour trash that her bunny suit couldn't mitigate. The beast responsible for that smell lumbered in the middle of the room like a huge lump of crumpled red tissue. Snores that sounded like horrifying growls echoed through the room. Long red tendrils, some as thick as anchor chains and others as thin as spaghetti, hung off the creature. Those were the remnants of the webbing network that had secured the monster to the cathedral back in New Orleans. Steel chains held it in place, attached to iron columns stretching from floor to ceiling. "How are we looking?" Kate asked when she reached Carr. He turned in his full white bunny suit and face mask.
"I think we're about ready to bring you in. Follow me."
Sammy joined them as they went to a bench filled with computer terminals and sat about 6 feet from the creature's restrained claws. Two other computer engineers worked at the keyboards. Next to them was a clear bioreactor about the size of a football. A series of microelectric arrays connected the blob of red webbing tissue growing inside the bioreactor. Sammy gestured to the bioreactor.
"The connections are complete."
"Good. Then the last thing we have to do is connect the webbing to the Mastermind," Kate said. Carr stood next to the bioreactor with another microelectric array in hand. The device looked to be nothing more than a series of circuits and metal prongs that Kate didn't know much about. She certainly wasn't the expert in brain-neural interfaces, but people on the team around her were. Sean joined them with his arms folded across his chest.
"We've prepped the connection tendril," he said.
"Bring it over, please," Kate said. Sean walked over to the beast's open palm, approaching fearlessly. Kate was a bit shocked to see him acting with such confidence. It was almost like the imminent threat from outside had sparked new courage in the young tech. From the Mastermind's hand, he dragged a red vine of tissue. It looked like an enormous piece of stringy, chewable bubble gum. Sean clamped the tissue into a vise on the table right next to the bioreactor. Carr then connected the microelectric array. Next, Sean moved a large surgical lens into place above the vise-gripped tendril.
"Okay," Sean said.
Carr bent down and peered through the lens to help him surgically attach the probes from the array into the tendril. Connecting nerve bundles one at a time required expert precision. To an outsider, what they were doing might have looked like nothing more than connecting some wires to a few chunks of meat. Kate's nerves were alive with coursing electricity, adrenaline pumping through her vessels. This was the ultimate experiment, connecting a mastermind to computers loaded with the programs the collaborators had been using to communicate. No one in the Allied States had ever done this, and it could change the course of the war in their favor. Carr pulled away from the tendril and nodded. It's connected. Sammy leaned toward the monitor on her bench. A moment later, she looked up.
Holy shit, I'm already getting something, she said. An electrical pulse.
A long groan escaped the monster's bulbous lips. The click of weapons being shouldered echoed around the room from the soldiers standing guard. Kate tensed up, but the monster quieted once more.
What else are you seeing? She asked. I'm getting a constant pulse, Sammy said. It looks to me just like a repeated signal to let the collaborator software know that the beast is connected.
Carr said, twisting to look at the beast. Nothing in English yet?
Not yet.
Sammy typed something on the computer.
Let me adjust something on our end.
Text scrolled on her screen. A series of ones repeated over and over, like they were appearing at the beat of the drum.
I think I've got this tuned right.
Sammy pointed to the screen excitedly.
The ones appear in the collaborator program when the mastermind is present, but not actively communicating. Kind of a neutral state.
So how do we get it to a non-neutral state? Kate said. Sammy gulped, locking her gaze with Kate.
I think it's waiting for an input. We need to experiment with it.
You can type a query that'll be translated through the webbing to the beast, right? Kate asked. Sammy nodded.
Ask it, what are our commands?
Sammy typed the words onto the computer terminal and hit the enter button. Everyone moved closer to the screen. For a second, nothing happened, just a series of more ones and the low rumble of the comatose mastermind's breathing. Then the beast started twitching. Some of the severed tendrils draping off its body whipped like live electrical wires fallen from a power line. The lab technicians retreated behind the iron columns. The soldiers around the perimeter advanced toward the center, their weapons trained on the monster. The giant's eyes fluttered open, and its yellow reptilian pupils flicked back and forth, surveilling its surroundings. The soldiers closed in, while the science team backed away. Kate held up a hand, hoping to keep the soldiers from acting too hastily.
Don't fire! Increase the anesthesia, Carr ordered.
The beast pulled its legs and arms toward its body. Then it started to stand. Metal protested as the columns and chains resisted the strength of the monster. Pops like rivets breaking loose sounded from where the columns met the ceiling.
We're losing it, Sean yelled.
The soldiers moved closer, weapons up.
Hold your fire, Kate yelled. More anesthesia,
Carr snapped at Sean. Kate watched Sean work quickly to increase the dose. She could feel the tension striking like lightning between the soldiers and the research team. If the beast broke free, it could kill everyone here. But if they killed it, they would lose everything they had fought for. This was their only chance at uncovering how the variants and collaborators were coordinating their attacks. The beast took a faltering step, fully upright now. It let out a bellow that shook the ceiling, releasing dust. A few bolts fell free and clanged on the floor. Researchers scattered as it took another step, dragging the huge IV lines attached to its body. Kate moved away from the beast, stumbling into a lab station.
What do we do?
One of the soldiers yelled.
Light this motherfucker up,
replied one of the men.
No!
Kate shouted. The soldiers moved closer, hunched, weapons aimed at the head.
Not yet. You can't,
Sean cried, adjusting the dosage on the IV. He moved slightly to obstruct the target.
Out of the way,
said one of the soldiers. Defiant, Sean remained in place. Kate started to walk toward him when the creature staggered. The guards moved for a better vantage, but all halted as it slumped to the ground between the iron posts with a thud. The rifles remained aimed at the beast, but the soldiers calmed down.
Dr. Lovato, I think, Sammy said in a quiet voice. I think it worked.
Kate went back to look at the screen, her nerves still frayed. Words scrolled across the monitor.
Command.
Command, where am I? What is happening? Who are you? What is this place? You are my enemy.
The mastermind had spoken through the neural computer interface, and they had been able to listen. Kate found herself smiling. Such a rare reaction, she hardly recognized it. They finally had their key. Soon they would have full access to the Variant Collaborator Network. This was the beginning of the end for the Variants.
Chapter 19.
Fitz had prepared mentally for a lot of different things, but finding traps built for Variants was the last on his list. Coupled with the heavy fog, the traps and terrain made their advance extremely dangerous. Fitz was grateful now more than ever they had Dohai to guide them. If it weren't for the Navajo tracker, half of Team Ghost and the Wolfhounds following them would have been impaled by now. Dohai bent down to look at a snare trap they had just discovered. He glanced up at the tree and raised a brow.
"These guys are good," he whispered.
Fitz relayed the location of the trap to the others and then gave the advance. For the next hour, Dohai navigated the terrain expertly, uncovering more pits. The putrid odor of variants drifted out of some, but others were empty. They found a skeletal variant dangling from a snare in the trees, and another beast whose leg had been clamped nearly in two by a bear trap. Most of the fog had thankfully lifted, replaced by pale moonlight when they finally made it to a tree line. An unobstructed highway appeared before them. Beyond it were the scattered buildings of the National Accelerator Laboratory campus. Weeds had grown through the cracks in the broken asphalt of the road. Fitz crouched out of view to scope the area, searching for hostiles, human or monster. He didn't see anything alive, but he did see evidence of life. The roads had been cleared of charred and rusted vehicles.
But when?
His stomach dropped. If the pits were any indication, the people out here were organized and intelligent. They'd made this place their home and defended it. The real question was whether these would be the type of people who invited their guests in to share a meal, or the kind that made their guests into the meal. Dohai pointed to something a few hundred meters away. Fitz used his NVGs to search the darkness. In the green hue, he saw a tall fence barricading part of the town. Atop each post was something that confirmed these weren't collaborators. Collaborators didn't mount variant skulls on fence posts and trap the beasts in pits. But Fitz still didn't know if these people were allies or hostile, and there was only one way to find out. He gave the advance signal. As they crept through the overgrown grass leading up to the fence around the facilities, Fitz halted to scan parking lots containing rusted vehicles and shipping containers. It was a huge area to cover, and he split the team up with more hand signals. Normally, he would have sent Rico off with another team, but this time he sent Dohai and Mendez. He wanted that group to focus on tracking down the equipment while he surveyed what they were up against with his team. The men nodded back and set off with 10 wolfhounds around the north side. They headed toward a series of warehouses and neighborhoods that had mostly been taken back by nature. Singh took the remaining 10 men and followed Fitz, Ace, and Rico southward. If anything went wrong, they were to meet back near the freeway, their designated rally point. It was always hard seeing his team split off, but this was worse than normal. They were being dragged down by inexperienced soldiers. A harsh wind carrying the faint scent of a bonfire pulled him from his thoughts. The scent vanished as quick as it had emerged. He moved along the fence until they came to a corner concealed by a thicket of trees. Even here, among the foliage, the metal post sticking above them had a variant skull stuck on it. Fitz crouched down beside the fence and signaled to one of Singh's men. The one called Hopkins moved over with a pair of bolt cutters. He went to work snipping through the chain links. Then a pair of wolfhounds pulled the puckered chain link fence back. Rico ducked through, followed by Fitz. Then came Ace and Hopkins. A wall of trees demarcated the end of a parking lot, and Rico took them past those trunks. She halted on the other side, crouching. Fitz held his fist up to the wolfhounds, and then joined Rico and Ace. Rows of white buildings with tinted windows towered above a cracked asphalt parking lot. Through those fractures grew a mess of plants taking back the land. Shipping containers rose like small houses out of those tangled yellow weeds. Rico pointed at the west end, where tarps and tents rippled in the wind. Clotheslines were hung between the containers, with clothing flapping like tattered flags. Fitz gazed through his rifle's optics, glassing the makeshift village. In areas cleared of weeds, he spotted empty chairs and tables with plates and cups. It all looked recent. But where were these people? Everyone had just disappeared. He wondered if they would find variant tunnels or the site of a massacre on the other side of those big white buildings. If only they had been here a few hours earlier, maybe a few days, they might have been welcomed into this place. They could have entreated these people to help them with their mission, and even bring them back into the fold of the Allied States. Rico and Ace waited for orders. As much as Fitz hated sending them straight into this eerie setting, he had no other choice. Fitz took point with Hopkins, leading the team into the camp. New scents danced on the air, like the charcoal smell of grilled meat, along with something more putrid, an odor he had long grown used to, the scent of decaying flesh. They passed a shipping container with a door ajar. Fitz signaled Hopkins to open it and allow Ace inside. He aimed his weapon at the container, and with a gesture from Fitz, Hopkins pulled open the steel door. Before Ace could go inside, a wave of bones rolled out, rattling noisily against the patchwork pavement. Fitz flinched at the noise, anticipating a howling variant to call out. But it appeared most of the beasts around here were dead or too far away to hear the noise. He counted off 20 seconds in his mind before examining the bones. "Something is wrong with these," Rico whispered. She was right. The ribs were thick. Some even looked plated. The finger bones he saw were elongated, as were the femurs and arm bones. All the skulls looked smashed and malformed, but not because they had been damaged.
"Sweet Jesus. Those are variants," Hopkins said in a raised voice.
Fitz whipped around. Singh was already staring daggers at Hopkins. The lack of discipline made Fitz worry about stepping another foot into this gruesome place, but he had no choice. He gestured for Rico and the others to get back in formation and waited a few minutes to allow everyone to have a breath. The smell of death was more potent, and Fitz fought to contain the disgust welling up in his stomach. Another open shipping container lay ahead, one door open. An incessant droning buzzed from inside. Clouds of black flies swarmed the place. Fitz held in a breath and flicked on his infrared illuminator and laser designator to check the inside. He almost let out a gasp at the ghastly tableau. Meat hooks hung from the ceiling. Beastly carcasses dangled from those hooks, chunks of meat missing from their haunches and ribs. There was no mistaking it. The monsters had been slaughtered and were in the middle of being butchered. Fitz didn't want the wolfhounds to see this, especially Hopkins. He closed the door slightly and whispered to Rico.
"Over here,"
came a voice. Singh pointed around the container. Fitz rushed over with Rico to see a fire pit and a spit roast. The embers beneath the roast were still glowing slightly. All around the fire pit were abandoned bowls and silverware. The source of the scent he had smelled earlier. If those past couple of sights hadn't already confirmed Fitz's suspicions, this one did. The variant being barbecued on the spit roast had been cut like a tender hog. A chill shot down his spine. The chances of these people being friendly and hospitable were dying with each grisly find. He brought up his mini-mic, deciding this was worth breaking radio contact.
"Ghost 3, Ghost 1, do you copy?" he whispered over the comm. He was met only with the constant sizzle of static. "Ghost 3, Ghost 1, do you copy?"
Again, nothing. Three more times, and still no response. When Singh tried to ping his men, none of them replied.
"I can't get through," he said.
Fitz's guts tangled as he studied the charred variant.
If these people ate monsters, then what would they do with humans? He prayed to God the other team wasn't in danger of finding out, but with the lack of radio response, he couldn't help but wonder if they were next on the menu.
Boss, this is some bullshit,
Horn said.
Relax, Bighorn, Beckham said.
He eyed the children and their dogs clustered around cots with folded blankets. They had gone from a luxury apartment to the damp, claustrophobic, ancient bomb shelter. Ironically, the shelter was cleaner than the apartment, despite the dust. There were dozens of people here, families, single people. Most were either too young or old to fight. Those that weren't were supervising gaggles of children.
I thought this place would be safer, Horn said. And now we're in a Cold War bunker with a bunch of civvies that are looking at me like I've got a variant head growing from my stomach.
Beckham turned to see if he was exaggerating, but a quick scan of the wide room proved he was telling the truth. Everyone around the shelter snuck furtive glances their way. Some were far more obvious, openly gawking at them. His eyes gravitated to a middle-aged man in a wheelchair wearing an army veteran hat. He held a shotgun and watched the steel door that was guarded by two outpost soldiers.
I don't like feeling like a zoo animal, boss,
Horn growled.
You're definitely not helping matters by glaring back, man, Beckham said. They're probably worried you're going crazy in here. Now calm down, and let's talk to the kids.
Tasha and Jenny were each reading a book, but Javier was tapping his foot. He was bored and anxious. Beckham knew it wouldn't be long until the boys started asking more questions about why they were down here. Tasha surprised Beckham and beat Javier to it.
Dad, you gonna tell us what's really going on? She asked. This isn't just a safety drill, is it?
Jenny looked up from her book. Her freckled nose twitched as she prepared to sneeze. It came out in a blast of snot.
Come on, Jenny, you're not a little girl, Tasha said. Cover your nose.
Jenny dabbed at her nose with a handkerchief Horn gave her.
I can't help it, Jenny said. There's so much dust down here. It's probably my allergies kicking in.
Another person sneezed across the room, and a cough followed, the sounds echoing off the concrete walls and low ceiling like a chain reaction. A conversation broke out near a column where a family sat.
Why did they bring us down here?
Asked a woman holding a baby. She rocked it back and forth.
Are we in danger?
I heard they spotted variants, replied another woman.
Just a matter of time before they hit us, someone called out.
It's because of those scientists, said a husky woman with a rough smoker's voice. They brought something in during the dead of night. I heard the commotion. Whatever they're doing is probably not something the monsters like.
The first woman with the baby spoke again.